It was the only way to deal with the tension that grew in inverse proportion to the distance from their final destination. Things were different now. It wasn't just a training exercise, and their demeanor was adapting itself to a new reality. On a different sort of flight, a commercial airliner perhaps, where conversation might have been possible, they'd trade jokes, stories of amorous conquests, talk about home and family and plans for the future. But the noise of the C-141 denied them that. And so they traded brave smiles that hung under guarded eyes, each man alone with his thoughts and fears, needing to share them and deflect them, but unable to in the noisy cargo compartment of the Starlifter. That was why many of them exercised, just to work off the stress, to tire themselves enough for the oblivion of sleep. Kelly watched it, having seen and done it himself, alone with his own thoughts even more complex than theirs. "It's about rescue," Kelly told himself. What had started the whole adventure was saving Pam, and the fact of her death was his fault. Then he had killed, to get even, telling himself it was for her memory and for his love. But was that really true? What good things came from death? He'd tortured a man, and now he had to admit to himself that he'd taken satisfaction for Billy's pain. If Sandy had learned that, then what? What would she think of him? It was suddenly important to consider what she thought about him. She who worked so hard to save that girl, who nurtured and protected, following through on his more simple act of rescue. What would she think of someone who'd torn Billy's body apart one cell at a time? He could not, after all, stop all the evil in the world. He could not win the war to which he was now returning. And as skilled as this team of recon Marines was, they would not win the war either. They were going for something else. Their purpose was rescue. For while there could be little real satisfaction in the taking of life, saving life was ever something to recall with the deepest pride. That was his mission now, and must be his mission on returning. There were four other girls in the control of the ring. He'd get them clear somehow. And maybe he could somehow let the cops know what Henry was up to, and then they could deal with him. Somehow. How exactly, he wasn't sure. But at least then he could do something that memory would not try to wash away. And all he had to do was survive this mission. Kelly grunted to himself. No big deal, right? Tough guy, he told himself with bravado that rang false even within the confines of his own skull. I can do this. I've done it before. Strange, he thought, how the mind doesn't always remember the scary parts until it was too late. Maybe it was proximity. Maybe it was easier to consider dangers that were half a world away. But then, when you started getting closer, things changed. "Toughest part, Mr. Clark," Irvin said loudly, sitting down beside him after doing his 100 push-ups. "Ain't it the truth?" Kelly half-shouted back. "Something you ought to remember, Squid. You got inside and took me out that night, right?" Irvin grinned. "And I'm pretty damn good." "They ought not to be all that alert. They're home turf and all," Kelly observed after a moment. "Probably not. Anyway, not as alert as we were that night. Hell, we knew you were coming in. You kinda expect home troops, like, go home to the old lady every night, thinking about having a piece after dinner. Not like us, man." "Not many like us," Kelly agreed. He grinned. "Not many dumb as we are." Irvin slapped him on the shoulder. "You got that right, Clark." The master gunnery sergeant moved off to encourage the next man, which was his way of dealing with it. "Thanks, guns," Kelly thought, leaning back and forcing himself back into sleep. Alberto's was a place waiting to be fully discovered. A small and rather typical mom-and-pop Italian place where the veal was especially good. In fact, everything was good. And the couple who ran it waited patiently for the Post's food critic to wander in, bringing prosperity with him. Until then, they subsisted on the college crowd from nearby Georgetown University and a healthy local trade of neighborhood diners without which no restaurant could really survive. The only disappointing note was the music, schmaltzy tapes of Italian opera that oozed out of substandard speakers. The mom and pop in question would have to work on that, he thought. Henderson found a booth in the back. The waiter, probably an illegal Mexican who comically tried to mask his accent as Italian, lit the candle on the table with a match and went off for the gin and tonic the new customer wanted. Marvin arrived a few minutes later, dressed casually and carrying the evening paper, which he sat on the table. He was of Henderson's age, totally nondescript, not tall or short, portly or thin, his hair a neutral brown and of medium length, wearing glasses that might or might not have held prescription lenses. He wore a blue short-sleeved shirt without a tie, and looked like just another local resident who didn't feel like doing his own dinner tonight. "The Senators lost again," he said when the waiter arrived with Henderson's drink. "The house read for me," Marvin told the Mexican. "Si," the waiter said and moved off. Marvin had to be an illegal, Peter thought, appraising the man. As a staffer for a member of the Select Committee on Intelligence, Henderson had been briefed in by serious members of the FBI's Intelligence Division. Legal KGB officers had diplomatic covers, and if caught could only be pinged, declared persona non grata, and sent home. So they were secure from serious mishandling on the part of the American government, which was the good news. The bad news was that they were also more easily tracked, since their residences and automobiles were known. Illegals were just that, Soviet intelligence officers who came into the country with false papers, and who, if caught, would end up in federal prison until the next exchange, which could take years. Those facts explained Marvin's superb English. Any mistake he made would have serious consequences. That made his relaxed demeanor all the more remarkable. "Baseball fan, eh?" "I learned the game long ago. I was a pretty good shortstop, but I never learned to hit a curveball." The man grinned. Henderson smiled back. He'd seen satellite imagery of the very place where Marvin had learned his trade, that interesting little city northwest of Moscow. "How will it work?" "I like that. Good. Let's get down to business. We won't be doing this very often. You know why." Another smile. "Yeah, they say that winters at Leavenworth are a motherfucker." "Not a laughing matter, Peter," the KGB officer said. "This is a very serious business." "Please, not another bloody cowboy," Marvin thought to himself. "I know. Sorry," Henderson apologized. "I'm new to this. First of all, we need to set up a way of contacting me. Your apartment has curtains on the front windows. When they are all the way open or all the way closed, there is nothing to concern us. When there is, leave them halfway closed. I will check your windows twice a week, on Tuesday and Friday mornings about 9. Is that acceptable?"
"Yes, Marvin."
"For starters, Peter, we'll use a simple transfer method. I will park my car on a street close to your home. It's a dark blue Plymouth satellite with license number HVR309. Repeat that back to me. Don't ever write it down. HVR309. Put your messages in this." He passed something under the table. It was small and metallic. "Don't get it too close to your watch. There's a powerful magnet in it. When you walk past my car, you can bend down to pick up a piece of litter, or rest your foot on the bumper and tie your shoe. Just stick the container on the inside surface of the bumper. The magnet will hold it in place." It seemed very sophisticated to Henderson, though everything he'd just heard was kindergarten-level spycraft. This was good for the summer. Winter weather would require something else. The dinner menu arrived, and both men selected veal. "I have something now if you're interested," Henderson told the KGB officer. "Might as well let them know how important I am." Marvin, whose real name was Ivan Alexeyevich Yegorov, had a real job and everything that went along with it. Employed by the Aetna Casualty and Surety Company as a loss control representative, He'd been through company training on Farmington Avenue in Hartford, Connecticut, before returning to the Washington Regional Office, and his job was to identify safety hazards at the many clients of the company, known in the trade as risks. Selected mainly for its mobility, the post even came with a company car, the job carried with it the unexpected bonus of visiting the offices of various government contractors, whose employees were not always as careful covering up the papers on their desks as they ought to have been. His immediate boss was delighted with Marvin's performance. His new man was highly observant and downright superb at documenting his business affairs. He'd already turned down promotion and transfer to Detroit. "Sorry, boss, but I just like the Washington area too much," which didn't bother his supervisor at all. A guy with his skills, holding a fairly low-paying job, just made his part of the office look all the better. For Marvin, the job meant being out of the office 4 days out of five, which allowed him to meet people whenever and wherever he wished, along with a free car. Aetna even paid gas and maintenance. And a life so comfortable that had he believed in God, he might have thought himself dead and in heaven. A genuine love for baseball took him to RFK Stadium, where the anonymity of the crowd was as perfect a place for brush passes and other meets as the KGB field operations manual dared to hope for. All in all, Captain Yegorov was a man on the way up, comfortable with his cover and his surroundings, doing his duty for his country. He'd even managed to arrive in America just in time to catch the sexual revolution. All he really missed was the vodka, something Americans did poorly. "Isn't this interesting?" Marvin asked himself in his Chevy Chase apartment. It was downright hilarious that he had learned about a high-level Russian intelligence operation from an American, and here was a chance to hurt his country's main enemy through surrogates, if they could get things moving in time. He would also be able to inform his control officers of something the Soviet Air Force cretins had running that had significant implications for the Soviet Union's defense. They'd probably try to take that operation over. You couldn't trust pilots. It had to be a PVO Stranya officer doing the questioning, he was sure, with something as important as national defense. He made his notes, photographed them, and rewound the film into the tiny cassette. His first appointment tomorrow was an early call at a local contractor. From there he would stop off to have breakfast at a Howard Johnson's, where he'd make his transfer. The cassette would be in Moscow in 2 days, maybe three, by diplomatic pouch. Captain Yegorov ended his work for the evening just in time to catch the end of the Senators' game. Despite a ninth-inning homer by Frank Howard, they fell short again, losing to Cleveland 5-3. "Wasn't this something?" he thought, sipping at his beer. Henderson was a plum all by himself, and nobody had bothered to tell him, probably hadn't known, that he had his own source within the White House Office of National Security Affairs. Wasn't that a kick in the ass? Mission stress and all, it was a relief when the C-141 thumped down at Da Nang. They'd been in transit for a total of 23 noisy and mind-numbing hours, and that was quite long enough, they all thought, until reality struck them hard and fast. Scarcely had the cargo hatch opened when the smell hit them. It was what all veterans of this place came to think of as the smell of Vietnam. The contents of various latrines were dumped into barrels and burned with diesel fuel. "Smell of home," one Marine joked, badly, evoking isolated barks of semi-amusement. "Saddle up," Irvin shouted as the engine noise died. It took a little time. Reactions were slowed by fatigue and stiffness. Many shook their heads to clear off the dizziness induced by the earplugs, along with yawns and stretches which psychologists would have called typical nonverbal expressions of unease. The flight crew came aft just as the Marines left. Captain Albee went to them, thanking them for the ride, which had been smooth if long. The Air Force crew looked forward to several days of enforced crew rest after the marathon stint, not yet knowing that they would hold in this area until the team was ready to fly home, perhaps catching a few cargo hops back and forth to Clark. Then Albee led his men off the aircraft. Two trucks were waiting, and they drove to a different part of the airbase where two aircraft waited. These were Navy C-2A Greyhounds. With a few desultory moans, the Marines selected seats for the next part of their journey, a one-hour hop to USS Constellation. Once there, they boarded a pair of CH-46 Sea Knight helicopters for a transfer to USS Ogden, where, disoriented and exhausted by travel, they were led to capacious and empty troop quarters and bunks. Kelly watched them file off, wondering what came next for him. How was the trip? He turned to see Admiral Podolsky, dressed in wrinkled khakis and far too cheerful for the moment. Aviator's gotta be crazy, Kelly bitched. Does get kinda long. Follow me, the Admiral ordered, leading him into the superstructure. Kelly looked around first. Constellation was on the eastern horizon, and he could see aircraft flying off one end while others circled to land on the other. Two cruisers were in close attendance, and destroyers ringed the formation. It was part of the Navy which Kelly had rarely seen, the big blue team at work, commanding the ocean. "What's that?" he asked, pointing. "Russian fishing trawler, AGI," Podolsky waved Kelly through a watertight door. "Oh, that's just great." "Don't worry, we can deal with that," the Admiral assured him. Inside the superstructure, the two men headed up a series of ladders, finding flag quarters, or what passed for them at the moment. Admiral Podolsky had taken over the captain's in-port cabin for the duration of the mission, relegating Ogden's CO to his smaller accommodations nearer the bridge. There was a comfortable sitting room, and the ship's captain was there. "Welcome aboard," Captain Ted Franks said in greeting. "You're Clark?" "Yes, sir." Franks was a 50-year-old pro who'd been in amphibious ships since 1944. Ogden was his fifth and would be his last command. Short, pudgy, and losing his hair, he still had the look of a warrior on a face that was by turns good-natured and deadly serious. At the moment, it was the former. He waved Kelly to a chair next to a table in the center of which was a bottle of Jack Daniels. "That ain't legal," Kelly observed at once. "Well, not for me," Captain Franks agreed. "Aviator rations." "I arranged for them," Casimir Podolsky explained. "Brought them over from Connie. You need something to steady down after all that time with the air scouts." "Sir, I never argue with admirals." Kelly dropped two ice cubes into a tumbler and covered them with alcohol. "My XO is talking with Captain Albee and his people. They're all getting entertained, too," Franks added, meaning that every man had two miniatures on his assigned bunk. "Mr. Clark, our ship is yours. Anything we have, you got it." "Well, Captain, you surely know how to say hello." Kelly sipped at his drink, and the first touch of the booze made his body remember how wrung out he was. "So when do we start?"
4 days.
"You need two to recover from the trip," the Admiral said. "The submarine will be with us 2 days after that. The Marines go in Friday morning, depending on weather."
"Okay."
There was nothing else he could say.
"Only the XO and I know anything yet. Try not to spread things around. We've got a pretty good crew. The intel team is aboard and working. The medical team gets here tomorrow."
"Recon?" Podolsky handled that one.
"We'll have photos of the camp later today from a vigilante working off Connie. Then another set 12 hours before you move out. We have buffalo hunter shots, 5 days old. The camp is still there, still guarded, same as before."
"Items?" Kelly asked, using the code word for prisoners.
"We've only got 3 shots of Americans in the compound," Podolsky shrugged. "They don't make a camera yet that can see through a tile roof."
"Right." Kelly's face said it all.
"I'm worried about that, too," Kaz admitted.
Kelly turned. "Captain, you have an exercise place, something like that?"
"Weight room, aft of the crew's mess. Like I said, it's yours if you want it."
He finished off his drink.
"Well, I think I need to get some rack time." "You'll mess with the Marines. You'll like the food here," Captain Franks promised.
"Fair enough."
"I saw 2 men not wearing their hard hats," Marvin Wilson said to the boss. I'll talk to them. Aside from that, thanks a lot for your cooperation. He'd made a total of 11 safety recommendations, and the owner of the cement company had adopted every one, hoping for a reduction in his insurance rates. Marvin took off his white hard hat and wiped the sweat from his brow. It was going to be a hot one. The summer climate was not all that much unlike Moscow, but more humid. At least the winters were milder. You know, if they made these things with little holes in them for ventilation, they'd be a lot more comfortable to wear. I've said that myself, Captain Yegorov agreed, heading off to his car. 15 minutes later, he pulled into a Howard Johnson's. The blue Plymouth took a spot along the west side of the building, and as he got out, a patron inside finished off his coffee and left his spot at the counter, along with a quarter tip to thrill the waitress. The restaurant had a double set of doors to save on the air conditioning bill, and when the two men met there, just the two of them, moving, with the glass of the doors interfering with anyone who might be observing them, the film was passed. Yegorov Wilson continued inside, and a legal KGB major named Ishchenko went his way. Relieved of his burden for the day, Marvin Wilson sat at the counter and ordered orange juice to start. There were so many good things to eat in America. I'm eating too much. It was probably true, but it didn't stop Doris from attacking the pile of hotcakes. Sarah didn't understand the Americans' love for emaciation. You lost plenty in the last 2 weeks. It won't hurt you to put a little back, Sarah Rosen told her graduating patient. Sarah's Buick was parked outside, and today would see them in Pittsburgh. Sandy had worked on Doris's hair a little more, and made one more trip to get clothes that befitted the day, a beige silk blouse and a burgundy skirt that ended just above the knee. The prodigal son could return home in rags, but the daughter had to arrive with some pride. I don't know what to say, Doris Brown told them, standing to collect the dishes. You just keep getting better, Sarah replied. They went out to the car, and Doris got in the back. If nothing else, Kelly had taught them caution. Dr. Sarah Rosen headed out quickly, turning north on Loch Raven, getting on the Baltimore Beltway and heading west to Interstate 70. The posted limit on the new highway was 70 miles per hour, and Sarah exceeded it, pushing her heavy Buick northwest toward the Catoctin Mountains, every mile between them and the city an additional safety factor. And by the time they passed Hagerstown, she relaxed and started enjoying the ride. What were the chances, after all, of being spotted in a moving car? It was a surprisingly quiet ride. They'd talked themselves out in the previous few days as Doris had returned to a condition approximating normality. She still needed drug counseling and seriously needed psychiatric help. But Sarah had already taken care of that with a colleague at the University of Pittsburgh's excellent medical school, a 60-ish woman who knew not to report things to the local police, assured that that part of the matter was already in hand. In the silence of the car, Sandy and Sarah could feel the tension build. It was something they'd talked about. Doris was returning to a home and a father she'd left for a life that had nearly become a death. For many months, the principal component of her new life would be guilt, part earned, part not. On the whole, she was a very lucky young lady, something Doris had yet to grasp. She was, first of all, alive. With her confidence and self-esteem restored, she might, in 2 or 3 years, be able to continue her life on a course so normal that no one would ever suspect her past or notice the fading scars. Restored health would change this girl, returning her not only to her father, but also to the world of real people. Perhaps she might even become stronger, Sarah hoped, if the psychiatrist brought her along slowly and carefully. Dr. Michelle Bryant had a stellar reputation, a correct one, she hoped. For Dr. Rosen, still racing west slightly over the legal limit, this was one of the hard parts of medicine. She had to let the patient go with the job not yet complete. Her clinical work with drug abusers had prepared her for it, but those jobs, like this one, were never really finished. It was just that there came a time when you had to let go, hoping and trusting that the patient could do the rest. Perhaps sending your daughter off to be married was like this, Sarah thought. It could have been so much worse in so many ways. Over the phone, her father seemed a decent man, and Sarah Rosen didn't need a specialization in psychiatry to know that more than anything else, Doris needed a relationship with an honorable and loving man so that she could one day develop another such relationship that would last her lifetime. That was now the job of others, but it didn't stop Sarah from worrying about her patient. Every doctor can be a Jewish mother, and in her case, it was difficult to avoid. The hills were steep in Pittsburgh. Doris directed them along the Monongahela River and up the right street, suddenly tense while Sandy checked the numbers on the houses. And there it was. Sarah pulled the red Buick into a parking place, and everyone took a deep breath. "You okay?" she asked Doris, getting a frightened nod in response. "He's your father, honey. He loves you." There was nothing remarkable about Raymond Brown, Sarah saw a moment later. He must have been waiting at the door for hours, and he too was nervous, coming down the cracked concrete steps, holding the rail as he did so with a trembling hand. He opened the car door, helping Sandy out with awkward gallantry. Then he reached inside, and though he was trying to be brave and impassive, when his fingers touched Doris's, the man burst into tears. Doris tripped coming out of the car, and her father kept her from falling, and clutched her to his chest. "Oh, Daddy!" Sandy O'Toole turned away, not put off by the emotion of the moment, but wanting them to have it alone, and the look she gave Dr. Rosen was its own culminating moment for people of their profession. Both medics bit their lips and examined the other's moist eyes. "Let's get you inside, baby," Ray Brown said, taking his little girl up the steps, needing to have her in his house and under his protection. The other two women followed without being bidden. The living room was surprisingly dark. A day sleeper, Mr. Brown had added dark shades to his home and had forgotten to raise them this day. It was a cluttered room of braided rugs and overstuffed 40s furniture, small mahogany tables with lace-like doilies. There were framed photos everywhere. A dead wife, a dead son, and a lost daughter. Four of those. In the dark security of the house, father clutched daughter again. "Honey," he said, recounting words that he'd been practicing for days. "The things I said. I was wrong. I was so damned wrong. It's okay, Daddy. Thank you for letting me." "Dory, you're my little girl." Nothing more had to be said. That hug lasted over a minute, and then she had to draw back with a giggle. "I have to go." "The bathroom's in the same place," her father said, wiping his own eyes. Doris moved off, finding the stairs and going up. Raymond Brown turned his attention to his guest. I have lunch ready." He paused awkwardly. This wasn't a time for good manners or considered words. "I don't know what I'm supposed to say." "That's okay." Sarah smiled her benign doctor's smile, the sort that told him that everything was all right, even though it wasn't, really. "But we need to talk. This is Sandy O'Toole, by the way. Sandy's a nurse, and she's more responsible for your daughter's recovery than I am." "Hi," Sandy said, and handshakes were exchanged all around. "Doris still needs a lot of help, Mr. Brown," Dr. Rosen said. "She's been through a really terrible time. Can we talk a little bit?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Please, sit down. Can I get you anything?" he asked urgently. "I've set your daughter up with a doctor at Pitt. Her name's Michelle Bryant. She's a psychiatrist."
"You mean Doris is sick?"
Sarah shook her head. "Oh, no, not really. But she's been through a very bad time, and good medical attention will help her recover a lot faster. Do you understand?"
"Doc, I will do anything you tell me, okay? I've got all the medical insurance I need through the company."
"Don't worry about that. Michelle will handle this as a matter of professional courtesy. You have to go there with Doris. Now, it is very important that you understand she's been through a really horrible experience. Terrible things. She's got to get better. She's going to recover fully, but you have to do your part. Michelle can explain all that better than I can. What I'm telling you, Mr. Brown, is this.
No matter what awful things you learn, please.
Doc, he interrupted softly, that's my little girl. She's all I have, and I'm not going to foul up and lose her again. I'd rather die.
Mr. Brown, that is exactly what we needed to hear.
Kelly awoke at 1 a.m. local time. The big slug of whiskey he'd downed along the way had blessedly not resulted in a hangover. In fact, he felt unusually rested. The gentle rocking of the ship had soothed his body during the day/night, and lying in the darkness of his officers' accommodations, he heard the gentle creaks of steel compressing and expanding as USS Ogden turned to port. He made his way to the shower, using cold water to wake himself up. In 10 minutes he was dressed and presentable. It was time to explore the ship. Warships never sleep. Though most work details were synchronized to daylight hours, the unbending watch cycle of the Navy meant that men were always moving about. No less than 100 of the ship's crew were always at their duty stations, and many others were circulating about the dimly lit passageways on their way to minor maintenance tasks. Others were lounging in the mess areas, catching up on reading or letter writing. He was dressed in striped fatigues. There was a name tag that said Clark, but no badges of rank. In the eyes of the crew, that made Mr. Clark a civilian, and already they were whispering that he was a CIA guy, to the natural accompaniment of James Bond jokes that evaporated on the sight of him. The sailors stood aside in the passageways as he wandered around, greeting him with respectful nods that he acknowledged, bemused to have officer status. Though only the captain and executive officer knew what this mission was all about, the sailors weren't dumb. You didn't send a ship all the way from Dago just to support a short platoon of Marines unless there was one hell of a good reason. And the badass bunch that had come aboard looked like the sort to make John Wayne take a respectful step back. Kelly found the flight deck. 3 sailors were walking there, too. Connie was still on the horizon, still operating aircraft whose strobes blinked away against the stars. In a few minutes, his eyes adapted to the darkness. There were destroyers present, a few thousand yards out. Aloft on Ogden, radar antennas turned to the hum of electric motors, but the dominating sound was the continuous broom-like swish of steel hull parting water. "Jesus, it's pretty," he said, mainly to himself. Kelly headed back into the superstructure and wandered forward and upwards until he found the Combat Information Center. Captain Franks was there, sleepless, as many captains tended to be. "Feeling better?" the CO asked. "Yes, sir." Kelly looked down at the plot, counting the ships in this formation, designated TF-77.1. Lots of radars were up and running because North Vietnam had an air force and might someday try to do something really dumb. "Which one's the AGI?" "This is our Russian friend." Franks tapped the main display. "Doing the same thing we are. The Elint guys we have embarked are having a fine old time," the captain went on. "Normally they go out on little ships. We're like the Queen Mary for them."
"Pretty big," Kelly agreed. "Seems real empty, too."
"Yep. Well, no scuffles to worry about. Between my kids and the Marine kids, I mean. You need to look at some charts? I have the whole package under lock in my cabin."
"Sounds like a good idea, Cap'n. Maybe some coffee, too?"
Frank's at-sea cabin was comfortable enough. A steward brought coffee and breakfast. Kelly unfolded the chart, again examining the river he'd be taking up.
"Nice and deep," Franks observed.
"As far as I need it to be," Kelly agreed, munching on some toast.
"The objective's right here."
"Better you than me, my friend." Franks pulled a pair of dividers out of his pocket and walked off the distance.
"How long you been in this business?"
"Gator Navy?" Franks laughed. "Well, they kicked my ass out of Annapolis in 2.5 years. I wanted destroyers, so they gave me a first flight LSTXO as a JG, would you believe? First landing was Peleliu. I had my own command for Okinawa, then Incheon, Wonsan, Lebanon. I've scraped off a lot of paint on a lot of beaches. You think? He asked, looking up.
We are not here to fail, Captain.
Kelly had every twist of the river committed to memory. Yet he continued to look at the chart, an exact copy of the one he'd studied at Quantico, looking for something new, finding nothing. He continued to stare at it anyway.
You're going in alone?
Long swim, Mr. Clark, Franks observed.
I'll have some help, and I don't have to swim back, do I?
I suppose not. Sure will be nice to get those guys out.
Yes, sir.
Chapter 27 Insertion Phase 1 of Operation Boxwood Green began just before dawn. The carrier USS Constellation reversed her southerly course at the transmission of a single code word. Two cruisers and six destroyers matched her turn to port, and the handles on nine different sets of engine room annunciators were pushed down to the full setting. All of the various ships' boilers were fully online already, and as the warships heeled to starboard, they also started accelerating. The maneuver caught the Russian AGI crew by surprise. They'd expected Connie to turn the other way, into the wind, to commence flight operations. But unknown to them, the carrier was standing down this morning and racing northeast. The intelligence-gathering trawler also altered course, increasing power on her own in the vain hope of soon catching up with the carrier task force. That left Ogden with two Adams-class missile destroyer escorts, a sensible precaution after what had so recently happened to USS Pueblo off the Korean coast. Captain Franks watched the Russian ship disappear an hour later. Two more hours passed, just to be sure. At 8 that morning, a pair of AH-1 Huey Cobras completed their lonely overwater flight from the Marine Air Base at Da Nang, landing on Ogden's ample flight deck. The Russians might have wondered about the presence of two attack helicopters on the ship, which, their intelligence reports confidently told them, was on an electronic intelligence mission not unlike their own. Maintenance men already aboard immediately wheeled the Snakes to a sheltered spot and began a complete maintenance check which would verify the condition of every component. Members of Ogden's crew lit up their own machine shop, and skilled chief machinist's mates offered everything they had to the new arrivals. They were still not briefed on the mission, but it was clear now that something most unusual indeed was underway. The time for questioning was over. Whatever the hell it was, every resource of their ship was made available even before officers troubled themselves to relay that order to their various divisions. Cobra gunships meant action, and every man aboard knew they were a hell of a lot closer to North Vietnam than South. Speculation was running wild, but not that wild. They had a spook team aboard, then Marines, now gunships, and more helicopters would land this afternoon. The Navy medical corpsmen aboard were told to open up the ship's hospital spaces for new arrivals.
"We're going to raid the fuckers," a bosun's mate third observed to his chief.
"Don't spread that one around," the 28-year veteran growled back. "Who the fuck am I going to tell, Boats? Hey, man, I'm for it, okay?"
"What is my Navy coming to?" the veteran of Leyte Gulf asked himself.
"You, you, you," the junior man called, pointing to some new seamen. "Let's do a FOD walk-down." That started the detailed examination of the flight deck, searching for any object that might get sucked into an engine intake. He turned back to the bosun. "With your permission, Boats."
"Carry on."
College boys, the senior chief thought, avoiding the draft.
"And if I see anybody smoking out here, I'll tear him a new asshole," the salty third class told the new kids.
But the real action was in officers' country. "A lot of routine stuff," the intelligence officer told his visitors. "We've been working on their phone systems lately," Podolsky explained. "It makes them use radios more."
"Clever," Kelly noted. "Traffic from the objective?"
"Some, and one last night was in Russian."
"That's the indicator we want," the admiral said at once. There was only one reason for a Russian to be at Sender Green. "I hope we get that son of a bitch."
"Sir," Albie promised with a smile. "If he's there, he's got." Demeanors had changed again.
rested now and close to the objective, thoughts turned away from abstract dread and back into focus on the hard facts of the matter. Confidence had returned, leavened with caution and concern, but they had trained for this. They were now thinking of the things that would go right. The latest set of photos had come aboard, taken by an RA-5 vigilante that had screamed low over no less than 3 SAM sites to cover its interest in a minor and secret place. Kelly lifted the blow-ups. Still people in the towers. Guarding something, Albie agreed. No changes, I see, Kelly went on. Only one car. No trucks. Nothing much in the immediate area. Gentlemen, it looks pretty normal to me. Connie will hold position 40 miles off seaward. The medics cross deck today. The command team arrives tomorrow and the next day. Franks looked across the table. I go swimming, Kelly said. The film cassette sat, undeveloped, in a safe in the office of a section chief of the KGB's Washington station. In turn, part of the Soviet embassy, just a few blocks up 16th Street from the White House. Once the palatial home of George Mortimer Pullman, it had been purchased by the government of Nikolai II. It contained both the second oldest elevator and the largest espionage operation in the city. The volume of material generated by over 100 trained field officers meant that not all the information that came in through the door was processed locally, and Captain Yegorov was sufficiently junior that his section chief didn't deem his information worthy of inspection. The cassette finally went into a small manila envelope, which was sealed with wax, then found its way into the awkward canvas bag of a diplomatic courier who boarded a flight to Paris, flying first class, courtesy of Air France. At Orly, 8 hours later, the courier walked to catch an Aeroflot jet to Moscow, which developed into 3.5 hours of pleasant conversation with a KGB security officer who was his official escort for this part of the journey. In addition to his official duties, the courier did quite well for himself by purchasing various consumer goods on his regular trips west. The current item of choice was pantyhose, 2 pairs of which went to the KGB escort. Upon arriving in Moscow and walking past customs control, the waiting car took him into the city, where the first stop was not the Foreign Ministry, but KGB headquarters at No. 2 Dzerzhinsky Square. More than half the contents of the diplomatic pouch were handed over there, which included most of the flat pantyhose packages. 2 more hours allowed the courier to find his family flat, a bottle of vodka, and some needed sleep. The cassette landed on the desk of a KGB major. The identification chit told him which of his field force had originated it, and the desk officer filled out a form of his own, then called a subordinate to convey it to the photo lab for development. The lab, while large, was also quite busy today, and he'd have to wait a day, perhaps 2, his lieutenant told him on returning. The major nodded. Yegorov was a new, though promising, field officer, and was starting to develop an agent with interesting legislative connections. But it was expected that it would be a while before Cassius turned over anything of great importance. Raymond Brown left the University of Pittsburgh Medical School, struggling not to quiver with anger after their first visit to Dr. Bryant. It had actually gone quite well. Doris had explained many of the events of the preceding 3 years with a forthright, if brittle, voice, and throughout he'd held her hand to lend support, both physical and moral. Raymond Brown actually blamed himself for everything that had happened to his daughter. If only he'd controlled his temper that Friday night so long before. But he hadn't. It was done. He couldn't change things. He'd been a different person then. Now he was older and wiser, and so he controlled his rage on the walk to the car. This process was about the future, not the past. The psychiatrist had been very clear about that. He was determined to follow her guidance on everything. Father and daughter had dinner at a quiet family restaurant. He'd never learned to cook well, and talked about the neighborhood, which of Doris's childhood friends were doing what, in a gentle exercise at catching up on things. Raymond kept his voice low, telling himself to smile a lot and let Doris do most of the talking. Every so often her voice would slow, and the hurt look would reappear. That was his cue to change the subject, to say something nice about her appearance, maybe relate a story from the shop. Most of all, he had to be strong and steady for her. Over the 90 minutes of their first session with the doctor, he'd learned that the things he'd feared for 3 years had indeed come to pass, and somehow he knew that other things as yet unspoken were even worse. He would have to tap on undiscovered resources to keep his anger in, but his little girl needed him to be a rock, he told himself. A great big rock that she could hold on to, as solid as the hills on which his city was built. She needed other things, too. She needed to rediscover God. The doctor had agreed with him about it, and Ray Brown was going to take care of it, with the help of his pastor, he promised himself, staring into his little girl's eyes. It was good to be back at work. Sandy was running her floor again, her 2-week absence written off by Sam Rosen as a special duty assignment, which his status as a department chairman guaranteed would pass without question. The post-op patients were the usual collection of major and minor cases. Sandy's team organized and managed their care. Two of her fellow nurses asked a few questions about her absence. She answered merely by saying she'd done a special research project for Dr. Rosen, and that was enough, especially with a full and busy patient load. The other members of the nursing team saw that she was somewhat distracted. There was a distant look in her eyes from time to time, her thoughts elsewhere, dwelling on something. They didn't know what. Perhaps a man, they all hoped, glad to have the team leader back. Sandy was better at handling the surgeons than anyone else on the service, and with Professor Rosen backing her up, it made for a comfortable routine. "So, you replace Billy and Rick yet?" Morello asked. "That'll take a while, Eddie," Henry replied. "This is going to mess up our deliveries." "Ah, crap, you got that too complicated anyway." "Back off, Eddie," Tony Piaggi said. "Henry has a good routine set up. It's safe and it works." "And it's too complicated. Who's going to take care of Philadelphia now?" Morello demanded. "We're working on that," Tony answered. "All you're doing is dropping the stuff off and collecting the money, for Christ's sake. They're not going to rip anybody off. We're dealing with business people, remember?" "Not street niggers," he had the good sense not to add. That part of the message got across anyway. "No offense, Henry." Piaggi refilled the wine glasses. It was a gesture Morello found both patronizing and irritating. "Look," Morello said, leaning forward, "I helped set up this deal, remember? You might not even be starting with Philly yet if it wasn't for me." "What are you saying, Eddie?" "I'll make your damn delivery while Henry gets his shit back together. How hard is it? Shit, you got broads doing it for you." "Show a little panache," Morello thought. "Show them I have what it takes." Hell, at least he'd show the guys in Philly, and maybe they could do for him what Tony wouldn't do. "Yeah." "Sure you want to take the chance, Eddie?" Henry asked with an inward smile. This wop was so easy to predict. "Fuck yeah." "Okay," Tony said with a display of being impressed. "You make the call and set it up." Henry was right, Piaggi told himself. It had been Eddie all along, making his own move. How foolish. How easily dealt with. "Still nothing," Emmett Ryan said, summarizing the Invisible Man case. "All this evidence and nothing. Only thing that makes sense, Em, is somebody was making a move. Murders didn't just start and stop. There had to be a reason. The reason might be hard, even impossible to discover in many cases. But an organized and careful series of murders was a different story. It came down to two possibilities. One was that someone had launched a series of killings to cover the real target. That target had to be William Grayson, who had dropped from the face of the earth, probably never to return alive, and whose body might someday be discovered,
or not. Somebody very angry about something, very careful and very skilled, and that somebody, the invisible man, had taken it to that point and stopped there. How likely was that? Ryan asked himself. The answer was impossible to evaluate, but somehow the start-stop sequence seemed far too arbitrary. Far too much build-up for a single, seemingly inconsequential target. Whatever Grayson had been, he hadn't been the boss of anyone's organization. And if the murders had been a planned sequence, his death simply was not a logical stopping place. At least, Ryan frowned, that was what his instincts told him. He'd learned to trust those undefined inner feelings, as all cops do. And yet the killings had stopped. 3 more pushers had died in the last few weeks. He and Douglas had visited every crime scene, only to find that they'd been 2 quite ordinary robberies gone bad, with the 3rd a turf fight that one had lost and another won. The invisible man was gone, or at least inactive, and that fact blew away the theory which had to him seemed the most sensible explanation for the killings, leaving only something far less satisfying. The other possibility did make more sense, after a fashion. Someone had made a move on a drug ring as yet undiscovered by Mark Charon and his squad, eliminating pushers, doubtless encouraging them to switch allegiance to a new supplier. Under that construction, William Grayson had been somewhat more important in the great scheme of things, and perhaps there was another murder or two, as yet undiscovered, which had eliminated the command leadership of this notional ring. One more leap of imagination told Ryan that the ring taken down by the invisible man was the same he and Douglas had been chasing after, lo, these many months. It all tied together in a very neat, theoretical bundle. But murders rarely did that. Real murder wasn't like a TV cop show. You never figured it all out. When you knew who, you might never really learn why, at least not in a way that really satisfied. And the problem with applying elegant theories to the real-life fact of death was that people didn't fit theories terribly well. Moreover, even if that model for the events of the past month were correct, it had to mean that a highly organized, ruthless, and deadly efficient individual was now operating a criminal enterprise in Ryan City, which wasn't exactly good news. Tom, I just don't buy it.
Well, if he's your commando, why did he stop? Douglas asked.
Do I remember right, aren't you the guy who came up with that idea?
Yeah, so?
So you're not helping your lieutenant very much, Sergeant.
We have a nice weekend to think about it. Personally, I'm going to cut the grass and catch the doubleheader on Sunday and pretend I'm just a regular citizen. Our friend is gone, Em. I don't know where, but he might as well be on the other side of the world. Best guess, somebody from out of town who came here on a job, and he did the job, and now he's gone.
Wait a minute.
That was a new theory entirely. A contract assassin right out of the movies. And those people simply did not exist. But Douglas just headed out of the office, ending the chance for a discussion that might have demonstrated that each of the detectives was half wrong and half right. Weapons practice started under the watchful eyes of the command team, plus whatever sailors could find an excuse to come aft. The Marines told themselves that the 2 newly arrived admirals and the new CIA puke had to be as jet-lagged as they'd been upon arrival, not knowing that Maxwell, Greer, and Ritter had flown a VIP transport most of the way, taking the Pacific in easier hops, with drinks and comfortable seats. Trash was tossed over the side, with the ship moving at a stately 5 knots. The Marines perforated the various blocks of wood and paper sacks in an exercise that was more a matter of entertainment for the crew than real training value. Kelly took his turn, controlling his Car 15 with 2- and 3-round bursts, and hitting the target. When it was over, the men safed their weapons and headed back to their quarters. A chief stopped Kelly as he was re-entering the superstructure.
You're the guy going in alone?
You're not supposed to know that.
The chief machinist's mate just chuckled.
Follow me, sir.
They headed forward, diverting from the marine detail and finding themselves in Ogden's impressive machine shop. It had to be impressive, as it was designed not merely to service the ship herself,
but also the needs of whatever mobile equipment might be embarked. On one of the work tables, Kelly saw the sea sled he'd be using to head up the river. "We've had this aboard since San Diego, sir. Our chief electrician and I've been playing with it. We've stripped it down, cleaned everything, checked the batteries. They're good ones, by the way. It's got new seals, so it ought to keep the water out. We even tested it in the well deck. The guarantee says 5 hours. Deacon and I worked on it. It's good for 7, the chief said with quiet pride. I figured that might come in handy. It will, chief. Thank you. Now let's see this gun. Kelly handed it over after a moment's hesitation, and the chief started taking it apart. In 15 seconds it was field-stripped, but the chief didn't stop there. Hold on, Kelly snapped as the front sight assembly came off. It's too noisy, sir. You are going in alone, right? Yes, I am. The machinist didn't even look up. You want me to quiet this baby down, or do you like to advertise? You can't do that with a rifle. Says who? How far do you figure you have to shoot? Not more than 100 yards, probably not that much. Hell, I don't even want to have to use it. 'Cause it's noisy, right? The chief smiled. You want to watch me, sir? You're going to learn something. The chief walked the barrel over to a drill press. The proper bit was already in place, and under the watchful eyes of Kelly and 2 petty officers, he drilled a series of holes in the forward 6 inches of the hollow steel rod. Now, you can't silence a supersonic bullet all the way, but what you can do is trap all the gas, and that'll surely help. Even for a high-power cartridge? Gonzo, you all set up? Yeah, chief, a second-class named Gonzalez replied. The rifle barrel went onto a lathe, which cut a shallow but lengthy series of threads. I already got this made up. The chief held up a Ken-type suppressor, fully 3 inches in diameter and 14 inches long. It screwed nicely onto the end of the barrel. A gap in the can allowed reattachment of the front sights, which also locked the suppressor fully in place. How long did you work on this? 3 days, sir. When I looked over the arms we embarked, it wasn't hard to figure what you might need, and I had the spare time. So I played around some. But how the hell did you know I was going? We're exchanging signals with a sub. How hard is all that to figure out? How did you know that? Kelly demanded, knowing the answer even so. Ever know a ship that had secrets? Captain's got a yeoman. Yeoman talk, the machinist explained, completing the reassembly process. It makes the weapon about 6 inches longer. I hope you don't mind. Kelly shouldered the carbine. The balance was actually improved somewhat. He preferred a muzzle-heavy weapon since it made for better control. Very nice. He had to try it out, of course. Kelly and the chief headed aft. Along the way, the machinist got a discarded wooden box. On the fantail, Kelly slapped a full magazine into the carbine. The chief tossed the wood into the water and stepped back. Kelly shouldered the weapon and squeezed off his first round. Pop. A moment later came the sound of the bullet hitting the wood, actually somewhat louder than the report of the cartridge. He'd also distinctly heard the working of the bolt mechanism. This chief machinist's mate had done for a high-powered rifle what Kelly himself had done for a .22 pistol. The master craftsman smiled benignly. The only hard part's making sure there's enough gas to work the bolt. Try it full auto, sir. Kelly did that, rippling off 6 rounds. It still sounded like gunfire, but the actual noise generated was reduced by at least 95%. And that meant that no one could hear it beyond a couple 100 yards, as opposed to over 1,000 for a normal rifle. Good job, chief. Whatever you're up to, sir, you be careful here, the chief suggested, walking off without another word. You bet, Kelly told the water. He hefted the weapon a little more and emptied the magazine at the wood before it grew too far off. The bullets converted the wooden box into splinters to the accompaniment of small white fountains of seawater. You're ready, John. So was the weather, he learned a few minutes later. Perhaps the world's most sophisticated weather prediction service operated to support air operations over Vietnam. Not that the pilots really appreciated or acknowledged it. The senior meteorologist had come across from Constellation with the admirals. He moved his hands across a chart of isobars and the latest satellite photo. The showers start tomorrow.